Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Good morrow, everyone. Thank you for listening to a very special Valentine's Day episode of the FlixWise podcast. I'm your talk show host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And joining me today are two of my colleagues here at UW-Madison. First up, making his FlixWise debut, we have local god, Mr. Jacob Mertens. Hi, Jacob.
Hi, how's it going?
Mr. J, welcome to the show. Also joining us is my number one crush in all of Wisconsin, Miss Erica Moulton. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Dost thou see what I did there?
I did.
Yeah. Okay. They're all from the soundtrack.
Thou seest it.
Yeah.
That's good.
Cool.
So Erica's done this before?
Yeah. Well, you were on...
I was featured on the top, end of the year, top five list.
Okay. See, yeah.
But this is still like your first, like,
this is, yeah, for technically your first proper appearance, I would say, where you get like the whole intro and everything.
Yeah.
So on today's show, we're bringing you both a love story and a feud for the ages. No, we aren't discussing Bette Davis and Joan Crawford for once. I don't even know who I am if I'm not talking about Bette Davis and Joan Crawford.
It's very out of character.
Yeah, it's weird. On today's show, Jacob's on hand to tell listeners why Baz Luhrmann's Romeo plus Juliet is worthy of the FlixWise favorites list.
Yeah, I don't know the stakes of this list, but it seems like the stakes are high.
High. Couldn't be higher.
I have to really bring my A game.
This is high drama.
To get this film in.
I believe in you.
Just like the amazing play.
But I also believe...
I'll do what I can. I'm up against fierce competition
here.
It's so true.
Fierce competition coming from Erica, his arch rival. Erica's here to play the buzzkill and tell us why she thinks... DiCaprio's line readings are, well, a foul thing.
This is an ancient grudge.
Yeah, an ancient
grudge. And it will break to new mutiny today on this podcast.
All right. And I'm going to play the mediator and as well as judge and jury in this epic battle and decide if indeed Leo and Claire deserve a spot in our immortal film canon. Will I bite my thumb at Baz Luhrmann's 1996 adaptation of Old Willie's Tale of Star-Crossed Lovers? Or will my, admittedly, kind of nascent skepticism, I'm like on the fence here, but will it turn to pure love? Listen up to find out. All right, but first to kick things off, my pal Mona Riza, who's a diehard fan of this film, recorded an intro and explains why she thinks this film is worthy of the favorites list. Mona Riza, take it away.
Hey, FlixWise listeners and lovers. I'm Mona Riza de la Serna, here as a humble guest of Lady P, giving a brief synopsis of Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet and filling you in on why the film should be a FlixWise favorite. Heaved into a modern setting of opulence and excess, Luhrmann's interpretation is a life-giving adrenaline shot to the heart of one of Shakespeare's most basic and overly done stories about two star-crossed lovers and their untimely deaths. From the beginning of the film, with the prologue done as a television newscast, to the very last scene in which Romeo and Juliet end their lives in a church lit with blue neon crosses, the film is an ode to how to make something done time and time again new in the best way possible, which in this case was to abandon everything except the language. Although controversial to those who are Zeffirelli loyalists, this nouveau take is an excellent film not only due to the modernization and the over-the-top mise-en-scene, but for the acting and the music. If you've ever had a doubt in your heart about the acting, watch Harold Perrineau's delivery of the Queen Mab monologue and tell me that you're not simultaneously scared and seduced. He does this throughout the entire film. Then fast forward to Leo DiCaprio screeching, "Either thou or I or both must go with him." All the major performances were visceral and natural despite the juxtaposition of language and setting. Moving on to the soundtrack, in my opinion, there was never one more perfect. It's pop music at its best. The songs were relevant to the time and immaculate for establishing the tone of each scene. My personal favorite is Radiohead's Talk Show Host, used as Romeo's theme song and heaven to the ears of brooding teens. Then there's the saccharine sound of the Cardigan's Love Fool pairing dreamily with the obnoxiously overjoyed Romeo as he finds out the priest will marry him to Juliet. And until this day, I do not understand why Princes When Doves Cry is not sung by the choir at my church. I also wanted to give a special shout out to the brilliant costume designer Kim Barrett, who went on to design the iconic looks for the Matrix films. Putting the Montague boys in the Hawaiian shirts and the Capulet boys in tight black pants, boots, and vests is a seamless way to quickly establish the rivalry before the guns are even drawn in the film. Kim is also responsible for my 21-year obsession with finding the perfect pair of angel wings and the perfect white dress to be buried in one day. Anyway, I can go on and on about this film and break down how each scene is genius, but this would be a 15-hour episode. So, Lady P, take it away.
So, thank you, Monariza. That was an excellent summation of all the things that you love about the film. But now it is time for us to talk about the things that we either love about the film or dislike about the film. How to begin? I'm going to start with Jacob.
Oh, gosh.
Okay. Jacob, do you like Romeo plus Juliet?
Yeah. And I can explain why. I know, like, I think one of your prompts is about when we watched this the first time.
Mm-hmm.
In order to talk about why I like it, I feel like I have to, like, combine those two things, if
sure.
That's okay.
That's perfect.
So Baz Luhrmann, admittedly, like, I'm going to have a bias here because Baz Luhrmann is technically the reason that I love film. When I was first getting into film, I wasn't into film really at the time, and I went to Moulin Rouge, which I'm going to have to talk about a lot because I don't know how to talk about Romeo and Juliet without talking about Moulin Rouge.
That's allowed,
I think they're, at least my opinion, is intrinsically linked to that other film. But I went and watched that. I remember, like, the first, 20-odd minutes, my only thought was, like, this would be interesting to watch on drugs.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. As with all Luhrmann films.
Sure. Exactly. And I think that's a valid take mm-hmm. on Luhrmann.
Mm-hmm.
And then it got to the Your Song section, and, like, Ewan belts that first, like, high note, right? And all the lights in Paris go up, and then I was just transfixed. And I don't know if everyone can pinpoint their love of cinema to, like, a second of a particular film, but I can, and it's that second. And then I went on, my conquest to learn about film at large, and I just got more and more into it. And of course, in my discovery process, I backtracked on Luhrmann, and Strictly Ballroom is fine.
Okay.
But it's not, it's just the movie. Like, there's nothing really that idiosyncratic about it. Mm-hmm.
And not a lot to kind of suggest what's coming next from him, which is kind of the most interesting thing about it.
Well, that's one of the things that I think is most interesting about Romeo and Juliet, too.
Okay.
And then I watch Romeo and Juliet, and obviously the sort of idiosyncratic style there's a stronger link there. There's a stronger parallel. And I found myself really, really loving it in part for that connection. And one of the things that I think is most interesting about those two movies is the way the director plays with tonal contrasts, which is my take on what I think Erica is going to call, like, unevenness.
Contrast or dissonance.
Yeah.
Or just,
productive
a bad
dissonance.
Control of tone.
Ah, disagree on that. I think the control of tone is really interesting. I think music is integral to that.
Mm-hmm.
So thinking of a particular example of where that happens in Romeo and Juliet, you have this scene with Romeo and Friar Lawrence,
mm-hmm.
Where Friar Lawrence is like, this is a bad idea. What the hell are you doing, you stupid kid? This is me paraphrasing Shakespeare here. And then you have a pivot, a tonal, emotional pivot that happens on the beat of When Doves Cry, right? This choral you know, reimagining of When Doves Cry. And that moment allows the epiphany of Friar Lawrence to take place, where he realizes this can smooth the discord between the two families, right? And this happens in an instant, and it uses music in a very purposeful, intentional way in order to make that transition. And I think there that kind of control, I do think it's controlled personally. It's okay if other people don't. I think that happens in really interesting ways throughout this movie. It reminds me of one of the more, in Moulin Rouge, one of the more moments that I'm taken by is the Like a Virgin song, right? Where you have like this thoroughly silly reimagining of Like a Virgin, right? And in the middle of it, you have Satine like coughing up blood. And the music like drops down to this like these kind of like depressing tonal chords, and then it just like slowly lifts up from this despair back into the Duke in his take on Madonna. And those kind of tonal contrasts, they're extreme. They swing, you know, there's these huge mood swings throughout his films, which I think is one of the more interesting things about, you know, if you could say Baz Luhrmann cinema, at least Baz Luhrmann cinema up to Moulin Rouge. I'm not a Luhrmann supporter after that point. I thoroughly hate The Great Gatsby.
Interesting.
Australia?
Oh, God, the worst dialogue I've ever heard in the film.
One of the worst films I've ever had to experience in a theater.
Yes. So we're on the same
All right. We're already finding common ground. Yeah. I like this. I like it.
We might have to move to Australia to get there. That's kind of... that's a huge part of what I love about it, and the way that it plays with emotion and... I mean, I'm going to talk about this a little more, I think, but I don't want to take up the space I'm going to let.
All right. So that's one corner.
Yeah.
And the other, we have Erica.
Cons.
Yes.
I don't know. You're not all con.
No,
just
I'm definitely
to be clear.
Not. And, you know, there are things I agree with you about, certainly about the way he shifts within scenes using music and tone. One that I actually think is incredibly effective is in the party scene, going from just the absolute insanity at the beginning of that scene, which I think is great. And there are a lot of things I really like about this movie. I love Harold Perrineau, Paul Sorvino, you know, dressed in a toga, you know, mouthing along to, I think, Pavarotti, like just being insane, you know, that's fun. And he uses, you know, in the midst of all this insanity, you get the introduction of the Desiree song, the I'm Kissing You. And
the aquarium. Oh,
and
that's
I
so good.
Genuinely,
and the reflections.
We can absolutely agree on that. Yes. I think that scene is genius. I think that's the best way that, the meeting of Romeo and Juliet has ever been staged. Mm-hmm. I love it. I wish it wasn't surrounded by so much noise and so many things I don't like, and things where I think he's just throwing things out. That's what Luhrmann likes to do. He's throwing as much as he possibly can and just seeing what sticks to the wall. Mm-hmm. Some of it really does, and I think he's really successful. Some of it, I think, just falls so incredibly flat and just gets so annoying at a certain point, and overwhelming, and just kind of drowns out some of the good things that, like I said, I don't hate this movie. I think it's a perfectly fun, entertaining film. I think, it's amazing that it's making it accessible, Shakespeare accessible to young people and to people, audiences sort of all age groups and backgrounds. That's the way Shakespeare's meant to be experienced. You know, he wasn't by any stretch of the imagination sort of writing his plays just for rich people. He was writing his plays for everyone, anyone who could come to the theater, anyone who could pay a penny to go into the Globe could experience his plays. He did also, though, then go to court and perform for the rich people. But, he was writing it for everyone.
Sure, yeah. I think I probably should have mentioned this in the intro. But Erica, would you like to explain why you might have strong opinions about Shakespeare adaptations?
I have a master's in Shakespeare studies from King's College London and the Globe Theater. Uh-huh. So I spent a year studying in London, at the New Globe, which is a reconstruction of the original theater that's built on Bankside about, a couple hundred yards from the original Globe. And, the Globe's mission is to get to sort of, bring Shakespeare back to as close as to what it was actually like to experience it in the 17th century or late 16th century. And I think that there is absolutely something to be said for trying to hew close to the original text. But then I think there's also room for experimentation. And in a way, Lerman kind of wants it both ways in this film. He wants to use the original text. And I find that fascinating. And I hope we talk about that more. The fact that he's like religious about it. He doesn't change any of the words. And we were having this conversation, you know, about the guns, swords issue. You know, guns existed in Shakespeare's time. They could have just switched the word. But he is absolutely intent on fidelity. And that is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Do I get a counter
now? Go for it.
Sure.
I love the gun sword thing. Oh,
that's
I think
so
it's so
dumb.
Good.
Let's first explain what we're talking about,
okay.
Right?
Yeah. So, sure.
Yeah.
So you have these moments in the play where people are brandishing, you know, swords.
Swords, as they did in Shakespeare's
time.
And
what you actually have scenes that were sword fights, right?
Yes.
And in the film version, because it's modernized, they have like these little pistols and on the side. And admittedly, it's a cheesy gesture, but
it's
I love
so
it.
Cheesy.
It says like sword or dagger on it. So
or
it's
long
like,
sword.
It's his way of like.
I mean, my long sword.
It's his way of really taking, in my mind, really taking joy in playing with the anachronistic sort of approach to the film. So I think
the gold
like,
money thing, which is a little annoying.
So, but I don't think that's fidelity. I don't think that's fidelity at all. What I think that is that it's again, it's an issue of contrast. He likes, you know, showing like, here's what the play was and here's me, you know, reveling in it being set in modern times and being able to show this contrast in the most in-your-face flashy way possible. I think, you know, to get on board with what he's doing with the entire film is to get on board with swords.
Sure, that might just be where I kind of have the major problem, because that is the biggest issue I have with this film is the setting, is mm-hmm. where it's set, when it's set, and how he's using that particular setting.
Oh my gosh.
And I think it gets down to a fundamental misreading of the play itself. Like, for me, there's no tension in the play because I have no idea what these people are feuding about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, within Shakespeare's time, he's writing this play. It's not set in contemporary London. It's set in technically Italy because that's where the original poem comes from, the Arthur Brooke poem. But it would be understood by Shakespeare's audience to be set like hundreds of years ago,
mm-hmm.
back when there were feudal houses. And you also have to understand, like, they're coming out of a period of time.
It wasn't pirates? I thought they was pirates.
It's not pirates.
Is that like, is that a thing that people think, or am I just insane?
Wait. Oh, I think you might be thinking of Shakespeare in Love. Because this is a really funny story. So this is great. I love that we're talking about this. And I think this is amazing that people actually think that this is related to it. Okay, so Shakespeare got the idea for the play. None of his plays were his own original ideas, with maybe the exception of The Tempest. But from a poem called The Tragical Historii of Romeus and Juliet. And it was by Arthur Brooke. It was actually based on another Italian poem or old story. So Romeo and Juliet had their names. So the scene that we're talking about is in Romeo and in Shakespeare in Love. There's like a really funny scene in the bar where like Shakespeare's talking about how like, you know, as Joseph finds how like he's having writer's block and Christopher Marlowe like sidles up next to him and he's like, you know, what's your play called? And he's like, Romeo and Ethel, the pirate's daughter.
Right.
And he's like, how about Romeo and Juliet? And he's like, catchy name. So I think that's just an invention of Tom Stoppard.
Okay.
It was never called Romeo and Ethel, the pirate's daughter. It was always.
And
I mean, that's a shame.
Apparently
really,
just like
but...
stuck, like yeah. a little
no, it's
thorn the... in my paw. Or I'm like,
I think
they were
that
pirates.
Movie, that movie has a lasting effect for sure.
Sure, yeah.
But so back to the feudal houses. I mean, I think the interesting thing to think about is that in Shakespeare's time, you know, about the most kind of recent historical memory everyone has is of the War of the Roses. And he had just written three plays about the War of the Roses, the Henry VI plays. And it's all about feuding noble houses. And at that time, you know, young men would pledge loyalty to these houses, and that's where these grudges came from. These are from, like, these ancient political power struggles. And so, you know, people were really killing themselves or killing each other in the streets because of their loyalties to these houses. And when you update the setting and you make them, like, shipping magnates / gangsters? I don't know what the, like, if they're gangsters, then why do they have gigantic buildings with their names
right.
on them? It makes no sense to me. And and he's kind of like also hinting at like maybe kind of a racial different, like one of them sort of Hispanic, but like then they're not.
Yeah.
And it's just, I never feel that
I think
tension,
that's mainly just because he loves John Leguizamo. Like,
sure. But and then
I don't
Sorvino
think that's meant to be
kind of
like
plays
built
into
yeah. the
But like based
the
on the costume
dynamic.
Design of the Capulets. Is they're very they're kind of the Latino like
right,
they
right,
have
right,
the
right, right.
tattoos and the, you know, like, mariachi outfits
the
and
sort of Latino Catholicism.
Yeah. And there's tons of Catholic imagery in this movie, which is also really interesting. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I mean, that's for me just one of the fundamental things I don't get. Like, that's why I also love when, you know, there are tons of updated versions of Romeo and Juliet, my favorite being West Side Story. I mean, this is where, you know, when people are trying to update Shakespeare and thinking, like, what are the ancient grudges in our time? Racism is that, I mean, that is the most kind of persistent kind of ancient grudge of the 20th, 21st century that we were dealing with in America, and localizing the tension there makes perfect sense to me.
Sure.
Yeah, I guess that what you're saying sort of gets at a larger issue that I have with the film, which is that I'm really not sure what it's about, right?
Right.
Which, like, and maybe that speaks to the larger question of what is Romeo and Juliet about? And it's about something for me reading it as a middle school, as a maybe even an elementary school student, it was about love, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. And now reading it as an adult and being reintroduced to it, even in high school, it became clear it was about the focus was more on the sort of petty grievances between the families and sort of the kind of euphoria of young love, but not necessarily. It wasn't uncritical of that.
Sure.
Of
yeah. Shakespeare's, you know, like, certainly sure. being critical of, like, I mean, he like sets the whole thing up as like Romeo was in love with Rosalind like five
sure.
seconds ago. And
yeah.
he's like, oh, other girl.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that Baz Luhrmann kind of ascribes to the elementary school version of Romeo and Juliet. It is about these two children who fall in love, and it is beautiful and pure. And there's pool sex, and it's gorgeous. Right?
Yeah.
I guess, like, that it creates a kind of dissonance in my mind, which is like, how can this still resonate with me? How can this version still resonate with me as an adult, right? Mm. Because when I saw this movie when I was in elementary school, it meant the world. Like, it was the most beautiful thing that ever existed. And I loved the style, and I loved the, Jacob, everything that you've pointed to, all of the, we haven't really gotten to the stylistic flourishes,
sure.
but the kind of strange off-kilter tone, I think I felt like it was really well balanced. It was really, it created a sense of fun, but also you also had the like sort of sense of the magnitude of the situation, the tragedy.
Just, like when the storm comes
in,
scene where he's like, he's running Tybalt off the road
yes.
and you're intercutting that with like Juliet just going like, when's
God.
He gonna get
oh, no.
here? And
yeah.
he's like, die, Tybalt, die. Oh, so good. I think from my reading on this, and maybe this like validates Erica's point, but that's fine. My whole, like, rewatching this, I definitely had a different feeling about like the magnitude of this, and I was like, this is basically just like a teenage soap.
Mm-hmm. Which there's nothing wrong with that,
and there's nothing wrong with that.
All
in fact,
of the
like,
OC.
I was looking at like I was trying to find it online, and then I realized I would have to like be lazy and walk 4 or 5 feet and get my DVD of this. I was looking on Netflix, and it was seeing like, if you like Romeo and Juliet, you'll like Vampire Diaries and Gossip Girl
yeah.
and Pretty Little Liars. I'm like, yeah, Netflix gets it.
Yeah.
This is a teen soap. And it's a really good version of a teen soap. And that's part of, you know, either being like a soap opera or full-on opera, like that's what Baz Luhrmann is interested in, right? He's interested sure. in these high, ridiculous emotional overtures mm-hmm. and getting those sense of like changing emotions, you know, at a drop of a hat,
mm-hmm.
which again is why I think to appreciate this, you had to buy into that, and you also had to buy into how music is helping facilitate that.
Mm. So an interesting thing, this with these like, you know, this intense register that he's working in.
Mm-hmm.
I completely agree. This is obviously a lifelong fascination of his, and you know, he loves soap and things that are, you know, super stylized. But for me, he doesn't ever really localize it. Well, I guess he is localizing it with Romeo. So, like, that is a question I had watching this. It's like, whose story is this? Because that's always an interesting question when I see productions of this. Like, I always ask myself, who are they centering the drama around? And I think it's pretty unquestionable in this film that it's around Romeo.
Oh, undoubtedly.
Unquestionable.
Yeah.
Another problem I have with the play, because, or with the film,
yeah.
This version, because I've always seen it as Juliet's play.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I find most radical about it is I agree that it is clearly a teenage kind of soap opera, but it's a play written in the 1590s that gives a teenage girl a vibrant sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And that is interested in her sexuality and her sexual desire.
You don't think that's maintained in the film?
I don't think it is as much. I think he kind of cuts.
We go to bed.
Yeah, but it's not about
her. Got him under the covers.
But it's not about her. That's the thing that I think, you know, the scene you were pointing to, the intercutting between Romeo killing Tybalt and her speech, that speech gets lost because it's just, there's so much loudness around it, and you don't ever really listen to what she's saying in that scene, which is, this is a scene of a young woman who's like, I want to have sex with my husband so badly. I'm so, like, horny right now. And it's really about that.
I don't think that's lost, though. I think, you know, it depends on the contrast.
Yeah,
so
but then
it does.
What follows is interesting, because then they cut that entire rest of the scene where she finds out that Romeo slew Tybalt, which is crazy to me. I was trying to remember what they had cut, and the fact that, like, she has so many lines in this play. She's actually, Juliet has the third most lines of any female character in Shakespeare, which is crazy. She's supposed to be 13 or 14. Mm-hmm. He is letting her say a lot. And I feel like, you know, if anyone gets cut the most in Baz Luhrmann's version, it's her. He cuts her last speech. He cuts her major scene where she has to wrestle with the fact that her husband has killed her cousin. And that's a huge point in the play. She has to really think, like, how do I rectify these two things? This man that I love so much has just done this horrible thing to my family. And you just, all that's lost. And we commented on this when we were watching. We were like, wait a minute, did he forgot that he, like, totally just cut all of her lines at the end of the play? She just, like, wakes up, looks at him, picks up the gun, done.
Yep.
Which is just insane. I'm like, what?
Yep.
It's crazy. Okay, but yeah, so your response to that.
I actually think that's a perfectly valid critique. I will say, just for the end parts, you know, there's some intentional choices being made that I think leads to that happening. One of which I think is a pretty inspired choice, is that, you know, she sees him as...
Well, because she sees him as he's taking the poison.
Yeah, she sees him, but then he sees her.
Oh, yeah, for the second, right? Before he dies.
And he
sure.
actually has, like, he remixed the lines where he has the, and with the kiss I die, that happens after she is awake and kisses him. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, it's about, like, keeping that, you know, as an interaction between them and just ending it at that point because of how he kind of reimagined that scene.
Sure, and he does a lot of remixing in that, you know, in their interactions, like the most obvious being the balcony scene, which I think it kind of works.
The balcony scene's funny.
You know, I like
talk about that.
I
like
this, part of
it was like a silent film, like with him like walking a foot behind her. It's like, or like a Universal monster movie where like Frankenstein is just behind, like,
if
Abbott
that was
and Costello or something.
Anyone but Leonardo DiCaprio, that would be creepy. But if it's Leo, it's like fine. Just
right,
let
or
let
the
go
line where it's like, will thou leave me so dissatisfied, or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like any other
what
person.
What satisfaction canst thou have tonight? Yeah. And you're like, I don't know. I feel like there's some stuff you guys could do.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah, I mean, well, we talked about on our previous Leo-centered podcast, the Titanic episode, we talked about his comedic timing and how that's kind of an underutilized strength of his. And he really sells that balcony scene, right? The facial expression when he realizes he's been whispering sweet nothings into the nurse's ear.
It's like, oh, damn.
But I guess we're kind of jumping around a little bit, but since we're on the topic of DiCaprio.
This is like why I like Baz Luhrmann. I like jumping around.
It's okay. I guess, in keeping with the tenor of the phone. Exactly.
Yeah, the aesthetic.
Exactly.
The aesthetic of the film.
Exactly. But while we're on the subject of Mr. DiCaprio, let's talk about one, how pretty he is.
Mm. So pretty.
And, oh, good God. And
get behind that. Yeah.
Yeah. And just also beyond the face, which, I mean, I feel like we could spend a good 15 minutes on the
sure.
face alone.
We could do an entire
sure,
episode
absolutely.
Just about his face.
Yeah. But beyond that, I guess let's talk about his utility with the language, which there may be some difference of opinion
there
here. Yeah.
There may not be.
May not. Okay. Well, Monariza.
I don't know if I'm
going
to like die on that sword,
okay.
to be perfectly
okay.
honest.
Okay.
That's a bad sword to die on.
I'm just going to say I don't really care.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about the face first.
Okay. I'll face.
Let's
okay.
face first. I don't think there is a prettier human being ever. Then
wow.
well, I mean, there are a number of contenders, right?
Sure.
But as far
at
as
this
like,
particular age group, in particular,
yeah,
right?
like
that point in
yeah,
history,
yeah. yeah, I would say
he's number one.
I have a lot of thoughts about '90s teen heartthrobs, mm. but
right,
we'll
like
say
on the
that.
River Phoenix scale. Of
oh
hotness.
Yeah,
like that's my that's the barometer that I use to measure
sure.
all '90s heartthrobs.
I would say that DiCaprio's got even Mr. Phoenix beat. In this,
and at that point in history,
yeah,
sure.
I mean, I don't think it lasted for even in Titanic. He's not quite as beautiful as he is in this movie.
I think
this
that's
is shocking.
True.
Yeah,
but I, yeah,
I agree,
agree
with that.
He's yeah. just well. I think it's because he is a gorgeous human being.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Baz Luhrmann is like a little in love with him.
I
in
think
this
so.
Movie. Like,
yeah.
and I was watching interviews with him last night, and it's hilarious that he was talking about when he was casting him. He saw him in a gossip magazine, like in a paparazzi photo, and that's how he like discovered him. And he acted like he discovered him, which was really funny because like Leonardo DiCaprio at this point had already been nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah, for yeah. Gilbert
like,
Grape.
yeah.
like he was not an unknown actor, and Baz Luhrmann was like, I discovered him.
Yeah,
he discovered how hot he was.
Yeah. Discovered how
yeah.
hot he was. He
yeah.
absolutely. Did
yep.
he
yeah.
made Leo a heartthrob?
Yeah,
yep.
And then Leo
and
DiCaprio?
he should get credit for that.
Yeah,
I think.
He should. Not
we
from,
need to give Luhrmann credit.
Not from DiCaprio though. Then he spent like he made the mistake of Titanic, and that was like cemented that status. And then
yeah.
he spent the next decade like,
trying to like undermine
back
it. Yeah.
at you know clawing away at that label.
I'm a can serious we talk, actor.
Can we talk about? Okay, so I was watching it last night, and the most hilarious moment of like. Maximizing Leo's sex appeal, I think, happens when he learns that Juliet is dead, quote unquote dead, right?
Oh, yes.
And he pushes his friend away, and somehow the gesture of pushing his friend away undoes his
yes.
shirt.
yes.
And then he's like defying the stars with like his bare chest splayed out on
yes.
the ground. That is such a beautiful, deft maneuver to just be like, yes, here is Leo in all of his sexuality.
Yes.
Embrace him.
Yes. Also showcasing his really beautiful cry face, which
mm-hmm.
we could talk about cry face in this movie too. Because like,
we
got to
talk about Claire Danes ugly crying.
Yeah,
it's
I mean,
really
like,
good.
It's, yeah. she's an amazing ugly crier,
yes.
but like Leo does beautiful crying
mm-hmm.
like nobody's business.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those
talk
baby
about
blues.
Yeah, and just
style,
like the little
yeah.
like single tear
tears.
Rolling down. Meanwhile, Claire Danes is just losing it, like
snot,
full
and, like,
blown,
full
yeah, just
everything.
Screaming
yeah.
and. It's such a beautiful contrast. I love
know,
it so much.
I know. Really, truly one of Luhrmann's strengths.
Yeah.
Just really capturing. Yes. But it's not all beautiful baby blues. He occasionally has to speak.
Yeah, he opens his mouth.
You know.
there are aspects. Okay, I'm jumping the gun. I'm sorry.
But I don't know. Eric and I watched this together. We rewatched it together. And, you know, as the Shakespeare scholar in the house, I feel like you are probably best equipped to speak to just his readings, I guess. The way – does he emphasize certain points? Well, do you think he knows what he's saying, or is he just kind of like – reading lines like ours like is he even
words,
off
words,
book yet
words,
yeah,
words,
yeah.
Words,
yeah
words words
words yeah yeah like, do you think they're holding up cue cards for him behind the camera
a la, like Marlon Brando
yeah.
and the Godfather say this
yeah.
Yeah, you know, I might have been overly harsh when we watched it together. Here's the deal with actors saying lines written by someone 400 years ago. Yeah, it's a challenge. And they were going for something that was not a traditional production of Shakespeare. Like, mm-hmm. they weren't trying to do Zeffirelli. Mm-hmm. And Zeffirelli had to, like, cut most of, like Romeo and Juliet's lines because his actors in 1968, even though he worked with them for, like, months, still had trouble with the verse. And iambic pentameter is something that just doesn't come naturally to people, which is ironic because it's also kind of, like, supposed to mimic natural language. Mm. Heightened, but natural.
Yeah.
I think they do okay jobs some of the time. I think in his scenes with Pete Postlethwaite and in Claire Danes' scenes with Miriam Margolis playing the nurse, I actually think they do a great job because they're working with really talented actors. And clearly the two of them, Postlethwaite and Margolis, are the most well-equipped to say those lines in the film. Like, they're really, really seasoned actors. They know exactly what they're saying. And I think they really elevate, you know, Danes and DiCaprio's performances in those scenes. And they're both really talented actors in their own right. You know, both of them have obviously grown and, like, continued to do incredible work since then. Sometimes it gets away from them. And mm-hmm. sometimes, you know, their desire to kind of naturalize the lines works, and sometimes it doesn't. The ones that kill me the most are just, like, the Montague boys.
The boys! Oh, that's so good!
And, you know, props to Lerman. He gets the tones of what they're supposed to be saying, that kind of like rowdy boy energy, right enough that you don't really need to know what they're saying. Like, you get the gist of what they're saying, even if the young actors playing those, like Ben Folio, has no clue what he's saying.
No clue.
But it's fine because you kind of get the gist of it. And it's like, you know, if that's the, you know, portrait that a 13-year-old kid is getting of Shakespeare, like, that's fine.
Yeah.
They're going to enjoy it. They're going to understand what's happening. They might get a taste for some of the poetry. But it is one of the most beautiful plays ever written. I will die on that sword. And
it's not... Okay, so maybe I was too harsh on this pre-recording.
Yes.
I'm not saying that's not a well-written play. What I will say is that the characters are insufferably young. And, like, the whole young love thing... it's just silly to me. And some of the lines that are emphasizing that, I find silly. I feel like,
for instance,
in the vein of a soap. Hold on. I grab one.
Okay.
With love's light wings did I overperch... I'm sorry for the delivery.
Go for it.
Okay. With love's light wings did I overperch these walls, for stony limits cannot hold love out. And what love can do that dares love attempt. Keep in mind, he's known this woman for like 10 minutes now.
Sure.
So this might be the... in my case, my ability to just suspend disbelief. And that is like one of the things you just have to accept going into Romeo and Juliet is like, yes, they're young. A lot of people say they're stupid.
Yes.
And they make bad decisions and they end up killing
just
themselves.
Calm the hell down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, that is one of those things where you just have to accept that this is the plot of this play. And mm-hmm. you know, it's about love, but it's also about something that Shakespeare was really interested in, which was fate. So the play opens saying how it's going to end. It says they are a pair of star-crossed lovers, and what the role of fate was in people's lives and whether you had control over what was going to happen to you was something people were really interested in his time. And his, you know, his take is some people are just doomed.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the hatred...
I like that part of it.
Yeah, because of the hatred that has been engendered for generations, these two young people... are going to die. And for me, I find that tragic. Every time I think about it, like, I can actually get emotional talking about it because there's no reason for these young people to die. And they're going to die at the beginning of this play, and you know it. And I've never really seen a production that's accurately captured that tragedy to me or for me. And I hold out in the future for
someday
more productions. But, you know, as long as we keep making versions of Romeo and Juliet, I'll be happy.
Mm-hmm.
But the language is beautiful. And
yeah, I'm not saying the language isn't beautiful. I wasn't... I know I made it seem earlier like I was going to, like, throw Shakespeare under the bus. No, but I find something about the sort of young love immediately enamored mm-hmm. with this other person to be inherently silly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's okay to read it as inherently silly, like, or because it feeds into the sort of senselessness of everything. Like, if you had just, like, been able to get some perspective, which you can't do when you're younger, right? Mm-hmm. Like, when you're younger, everything is, like, you know, vitally important.
Yeah.
And as you get older, you realize, okay, I could get perspective here. Mm-hmm. I need to, like, take a step back and look at this thing. I think, you know... some of the lines just come through silly because of that.
Can I offer a counterline?
Please do.
No. Well, I mean, so, okay, this is back on my kind of harping on how much I love Juliet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so the line, my bounty is as boundless as the sea. My love for thee is deep. The more I give to thee, the more I have, for both are infinite. Always kills me. It's just so beautiful.
It feels like it needs to be on a motivational poster
it's so
a little
gorgeous.
Bit.
No. And that gets to something I do like about the movie is that I think his use of water imagery is perfect because there's so much water imagery.
Oh, yeah.
There is
in
a lot.
In the actual verse itself that it fits perfectly. Mm-hmm. And I love that they're in the pool.
The
and
pool
I love
is
that
so good.
They
when they go down,
the
bubbles are coming up.
Yeah.
Oh,
gorgeous.
Man.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. No, yeah. Okay. So,
we can agree.
So can I make a quick point before we go on? So, like, I think my basic defense, it's a half defense. I'm not saying they're reading the lines particularly well, but because I'm reading this basically as like a teen soap, I'm like, my bar is like, are they reading the lines about as well as if, you know, the OC was Shakespeare? They sure are.
I think they actually get a little better than that.
Sure. I mean,
but that's my bar. That's all I need. That's all I need for the story to work for me.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned like teen soap, you know, like Claire Danes is a teen soap star, right?
Oh, totally.
So she is reading these lines as if she were on My So-Called Life, right?
Like, it's a pretty interesting casting for both her and Leo, right?
Yeah. So, and Leo, I mean, not so much a teen soap, but like sort of
growing pains.
Yeah. I mean, he had kind of like an after school special storyline, if I remember correctly. It's been a long time. But I guess like I think of him as this kind of intense methody actor, even at that young age. So like they're both playing into those strengths, like you know,
he's kind of the James Dean, like you know, Montgomery Clift Brando. Like,
exactly.
That's how they were kind of packaging him at the time.
Exactly.
And,
And just for another thing that I do like about the vocal delivery is just the quality of both of their voices. Mm. I think they're both like really interesting voices. They both like they're very fragile. They're very raspy. They have this like feel like you can sort of break at any moment. Do they get the intentions down? No. Mm. Yeah, or intonations rather down. That's pretty iffy. But there is like a quality. I just like listening to it.
Sure. That's fair.
Certainly we like listening to Harold Perrineau's voice.
Thank you. Perfect transition. So if I think that the true highlight of this movie, like the best thing every time I watch it, I just appreciate it more and more is Mercutio. Bringing it. Yes.
Oh my God, he's so good.
So good. I think since you guys agree, I don't know, maybe we should just like move right along. I don't know. But,
well, there's some things that are, I think, worth pointing out
sure.
about it. I mean, so, okay, only, other than the prince, only black character in the film, used very intentionally. So Mercutio in the play is meant to be sort of set apart from Romeo and his buddies. And in the play, the reason is, like, he's a little older than them. Mm. And it's the idea is, like, he's kind of supposed to be more mature than them. He's not supposed to be embroiled in all these, like, teenage boy fights, but he just, like, hangs around them all the time. Mm. In this one, you know, the thing that sets him apart is race. Yeah. And he's certainly
race
playing that up.
And, and there's a queer dimension
there
as
absolutely.
Well.
Yeah, do you want to talk about a...
Well, I mean, the first thing that we see is him putting a close-up of him putting on lipstick.
And he's
dressed in drag, and he's pulling the invitation out from beneath his skirt. Or, you know, when he gets to the party, he's mouthing the words. Do you guys remember the song? I'm blanking on the actual song. Your heart. Yeah.
Like a great disco anthem.
But, you know, it's intentionally meant to mimic a kind of a, you know, like a cabaret scene or a drag show, which is an interesting choice, especially in 1996,
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes. And then, you know, another kind of...
This is 96. So it would have been shot, I think, in 95.
So another thing that, you know, I think we brought up when we were talking about it was, like, in terms of some of the imagery used, all the helicopter shots and things like that, kind of the evoking the LA riots, the Rodney King, you know, beating stuff. Like, there's all this weird stuff that he's invoking, and I don't think he really ends up using it for a purpose other than just to kind of create an atmosphere.
It's part of the melange.
That's very strange to me, that you would, like, purposely go out of your way to cast, like, two black actors and then use all of these, like, crazy LA riot like helicopter scenes.
Sure.
Why is he doing that? That's a genuine question I have.
Yeah. I think it's yet another thing that he sets up that doesn't really answer. There's there is a larger question here of what is the why of it all, right? I don't think he's that interested in fate. I don't think. No. I think he's interested in love. Like, that seems to be the overriding thing, just unabashed.
In his career, yeah.
Yeah, love.
Yeah, it's just literally the mantra of his next film.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the last frame of the film is the word love.
Right, exactly.
That's love.
Yeah. just like pure Eros, right? And I don't, but what is he trying to say about it? Like, that it is good, it is beautiful, I'm still not entirely sure.
Yeah.
But Jacob, what does this movie mean to you beyond, like, I mean, I think it's a great time, honestly. Mm-hmm. I think.
Sure.
Are we talking about, like, what is he doing with love? Is that the
What is he doing with love? Right. And why does this film speak to you so much? Right.
I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of it is the film is interested in the absence of love, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's when the movie slows down. And I think with the Baz Luhrmann films, those are the moments you have to look out for because everything is so frenetic and freewheeling. And when he slows down, that's a good indication of this is what he cares about. Mm-hmm. So the moments of Romeo – oh, I already see skeptic look – the moments of Romeo alone with that great Radiohead talk show host playing over it, and he's either lamenting not being with Rosalind or not being with Juliet. You know, he's interested in, like, maybe this is just his fixation with Leo too, but he's interested in sort of dwelling on that moment, right? And he's really interested in dwelling on the moment that he comes to find Juliet dead, right? Like, that is the slowest. It's the slowest cutting in the whole film, for sure. If we took the ASL, it would be at a crawl compared to the rest of the film. Mm-hmm. It's the scene that he sets up the most in terms of this kind of gorgeous, symmetrical, establishing shot with the crosses on each side of the aisle. And he's really interested in holding on that moment of just love being present and absent at the same time. So for me, I think that in terms of how he's using love, I think that's what's interesting about it, if that makes sense.
I don't know. Erica, what do you think?
So in terms of the style, this kind of goes back to the setting and my problem with it, and then also kind of why I like Moulin Rouge. So these are both films that are absolutely obsessed with love, finding love, losing love, you know, experiencing the ecstasies of love, and the sort of intense stylization that he brings to that topic and the world in Moulin Rouge, I think works so well because of the setting, because it's set in a bordello, because it's set in
a nightclub. I actually agree with this.
Yeah, and so that's why I think it's even more, it's like much more successful. It's his most successful
film. I completely agree.
Yeah.
I think we're going to get into that point because I think, well, continue.
This is a nightclub, like having this crazy, you know, like, overwhelming, you know, the first scene when Christian is at Moulin Rouge and he's just overwhelmed and the crazy cutting and everything, that works so well because it serves the story and it serves the character. Mm-hmm. And because he doesn't, Luhrmann in Romeo and Juliet doesn't have like a very firm fix on either of the characters other than like, hey, Leo is really pretty and hey, Claire Danes is kind of this like angsty teen girl from My So-Called Life I think he's sort of using the My So-Called Life as almost like a shorthand. Like, he doesn't invest a whole lot of time in like really, you know, showing who she is as a person. Mm-hmm. And then he cuts a lot of her lines. I'm so salty about it. I can't help it. I like Juliet. And so because of that, you know, the stylism sort of works sometimes when he, you know, in the When Doves Cry sequence, the party sequence, and then sometimes it's just noise to me.
Okay.
Sometimes, you know, I feel like saying Luhrmann slowing down means he wants you to pay attention to something is like, it feels kind of like cheating to me. Like, if you just like throw crazy, crazy noise, and then like cut it out, like all the time, and that's your one strategy, which is like, I don't think that's
his one strategy.
I don't think it's his one strategy, but he does use it a lot, where he's just like, you know, edit, like cut, and then, you know, like, let's have a scene of, you know, 15 seconds, and then you do pay attention to that. Mm-hmm. And it is a strategy, and sometimes it works. Sometimes it works, and it serves the story. Sometimes it's just like him being Bass. And those moments where I'm like, all right, I'm out.
Yeah.
I'm good.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of some particularly
like the opening scene. Yeah. It's so stupid.
The trailer? Or the gas station
yeah. scene. I think like, all right.
Yeah.
Oh, it's, I love
that's
that.
A lot.
You bite your thumb, sir.
Yeah.
You bite your thumb with us.
Sir. And I think, like, we can sit here and mock it, but, like, when I was 8 through 12, 13, I thought it was really cool and really accessible. It made this very kind of, I mean, it's challenging. It's dense. You know, it's verse. I wasn't used to it at all, obviously. And it made it really, really easy for me to understand. And to this day, like, I can go to a Shakespeare play and basically understand everything that they're saying. And
it was a Shakespeare gateway drug.
Exactly. Precisely.
Yeah, I love it. That's a great way to think about this. I'm happy with that.
Yeah. It's and I think it functions a lot like kind of a drug, right? Like the come down when you realize like maybe this may not be the it is flawed. There are drawbacks. There are side effects.
There's a hangover at some point.
All Baz Luhrmann movies should come with those like little side effects.
Exactly.
Some hair of the dog during the after credits sequence.
Exactly. in that regard, I think like it's pretty successful, you know, like as a way to make this text fun and exciting to young people, I think it totally succeeds. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do know people who even at a young age were like, this is dumb.
I know. I have a sister in high school still, and they watched it this year, and I think she said that they all liked it. But it is interesting to me, and this might transition to having us talk about the music, that I wonder how well it will age like as it goes on, because it is such a 90s movie. Like,
well, but then, like, you know, you could watch 1960s movies and it could feel really part of the period, but you still appreciate it.
Yeah,
but like it's kind of like, reveling in the kind
still
of culture
will like
of the time.
American Graffiti.
Yeah. They do, you know? Yeah.
Even though
I mean, that's really nostalgic for really the 50s, though,
well, this is going to be nostalgic for the 90s.
Yeah, but that was made in the that's a weird case because it's like a 70s movie. That's
nostalgic. Oh, that's true. Like it was designed to be nostalgic.
Exactly.
That's a fair point.
Yeah. But something like what I would hate to see happen is for this to be something like Easy Rider, where it's like this was a really important movie at the time, and now I watch it and go like.
Yeah.
Why do people like this? Or even something like The Graduate, which I understand why people like, and to me it's uneven.
Yeah.
And it bears a lot of the markers of the time period it was made. Obviously the soundtrack for one, but then there's also like the zooms and even just the overall kind of message of the film. This very pro boomer greatest generation, like anti-authority stance. Like, I don't know that has aged all that well. Mm-hmm. So, like, is this a Graduate situation?
Well, okay, so can I? I don't know if this is exactly answers your question, but I think we have to talk. I want to circle back on what Erica was saying about comparing the style of this to the style of Moulin Rouge.
Mm, okay,
because I agree with the point that Moulin Rouge it works better. And I think in a lot of ways, and this is something that's interesting to me about it, but in a lot of ways, this feels like a test run for Moulin Rouge, right, in terms of its sort of idiosyncratic style. Maybe that means it won't age as well because it feels sort of not as fully realized. But my thing with the style of Moulin Rouge, which I think was getting to what Erica was saying maybe, is that there's a center of gravity to it that just isn't present here. Like here it's, you know, it's all Verona, beach city, and it's flying around everywhere. There's no like well of gravity that the sort of all these like frenetic camera moves are revolving around. Whereas with Moulin Rouge,
right, you're oriented.
It's everything is oriented at the Moulin Rouge. You're going through the CG version of Bohemian Paris to the Moulin Rouge. You're from the little loft, you know, zooming down to the elephant, whatever the case may be. It's all centered there. Whereas this can feel a little bit chaotic for the sake of chaos. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work quite well. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I'm not gonna again like defend everything about this movie.
Okay.
But I agree with the point that you're making too, that there's a way that it sort of energizes the material. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Yeah.
That was a huge bet, like tread back.
Yeah, no, but I think it's that's a good point. And it's important to say, I don't know, actually I think now I need to defend Romeo and Juliet a little bit. Because I don't know. I guess now that as we're talking, I'm starting to feel like slightly more defensive just because.
Come over to my side. Yes.
No, seriously.
because I think like I love the time capsule element of this film. I love that this bold, audacious style was new and kind of, and it was unique at the time, right? And there are
like sort of poor imitations happening, you know, post this film as well, which is interesting.
Yeah, and I think that as much as I loved Moulin Rouge at the time, I think that this benefits from having like the best source material in the entire world. so, I mean, despite like the sort of it not having the proper the focus that I would like, I think that there's still something to taking this text that feels like so familiar, even at a young age, even in elementary school, you still know kind of, you know, oh, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo.
Yeah.
And being able to sort of rejuvenate it in this way, I think even if it's not a perfect film, I think there's something about that feat that is kind of worthy of canonization.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so to your time capsule point, and this is something that I always love just about Shakespeare, is so I think this is Marjorie Garber, who's a scholar at Harvard. I think this is something she says, and some other people have said it. But so every Shakespeare play is set in three different times. It's set in the time that he's writing about in the play. It's set at the time that he wrote it. And it's set at the time that you're setting it. And as a product of the mid-90s, like what are the mid-90s about? Like in terms of pop culture, like this is a time of angsty teens, of like angsty teen dramas and like this huge emphasis on them. Like, I mean, this is how many shows about young star-crossed teen lovers came on the air in the 90s?
90210.
So many of them.
Yeah.
So many of them. And so in terms of like appealing to this demographic that is, you know, sort of really, really robust at that time. Mm-hmm. Like, certainly Baz was very smart to do that. It's like the MTV generation.
This may be his most savvy film.
Yes, it's incredibly savvy. He knows exactly who he is pandering to the entire way through.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. And it does lend it this kind of time capsule. Like, if you want to know what people thought teens were interested in the 90s, hey, watch this movie because it will go through all of it.
Yes. Yes.
Like writing your own bad poetry, listening to Radiohead. It's all there.
Yeah.
It's all there.
Yeah. So he uses these shorthands really well, as we've talked about, with even in the casting, but also in the soundtrack, right? And I do think we have to talk about this because everyone in my generation, and we're all roughly the same generation, I don't know that it will speak to us the same, all of us the same way, even with the slight variation in our ages. But this soundtrack was so formative. And I remember, even more than the movie, I remember the soundtrack. Mm. I remember, like, the music drops. I remember, you know.
Out of curiosity, though, because so the soundtrack, it's music inspired by, right? I was trying to remember, because I know some of it is featured, but there was a music inspired by track.
Is
or
there?
A CD.
I don't know. I had the Romeo and Juliet soundtrack.
Okay.
I don't remember if all of the songs on it getting, were in the movie.
Right, yeah. So I remember getting it and having it say, like, music inspired by it. And I was like, I recognized some of the songs, but then some of them were clearly just like, yeah, they're appealing to a market demographic.
Sure, yeah. They're packaging this and looking to sell it. Yes. Right, yeah. But some of the songs are, like, cued for a second. Like, the number one crush song that I alluded to earlier, that plays for half a second, you don't even get any words. It's just a little drop, tiny little drop.
I love, because it feels so weird when it happens too, right? And all of a sudden, you know, she's like in jeans and a t-shirt and her nurse is like in the fridge. Yeah. And like, all of a sudden it's just like, hey, we're in the 90s, we're in your living room.
Yeah. I love that scene.
Love it.
It's great.
I don't know. So do you remember listening to the, Jacob will ask you, do you remember listening to this soundtrack as a kid?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, this probably started, you know, my great love of Radiohead. Sorry, I have to be like
the, you're that guy.
I'm that guy. but I think, like, oh, God, I've probably listened to, it's at least going to be, like, top 10 most listened of all time, like, the exit music for a film. Mm. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Like, that was the thing, like, when I was, like, in this, like, not in, like, a somewhat ironic way, but just very, like, their love was beautiful, and it's gone now, and I listened to that song. Oh.
Yes.
Oh, it's so good.
Yes.
Oh. It still remains, like, one of the best, like, end credit song experiences of my cinematic life, I think.
Yeah. Erica?
I was 4 when the movie came out. Okay. So
a little younger, a little older.
So I didn't see it until it was on DVD, and it was actually my younger sister. This was her favorite movie for years. Like, when we were in middle school, like, she found this movie and we just, you know, she adored it. And so I watched it that way. And I really liked it back then. And we got the soundtrack, like, went to Walmart and, like, found it. And, I mean, we both really love the When Doves Cry cover. Like, that's such a gorgeous moment in the film. And whoever that kid is, he's... Voice of an angel. Yeah. And, you know, Lerman likes it so much that they actually go back to the kid again. Sure, and they're like, let's give him another number.
Yeah.
So I love that. Yeah. But, you know, I'm not a, like, kind of alternative rock like person. So it's not designed for me. Well, let's just say I'm not in the demographic.
Just like that opening riff of the talk show host is just so perfect, like setting the tone of what he's trying to do with, like, the modern take of it. I love it so much.
Yeah.
It's a great tone setter.
Yeah. And then back to your point about this sort of sowing the seeds of what would come later in Moulin Rouge, which is a musical, right?
Yeah.
I think that this soundtrack is used in a similar way as the Moulin Rouge sort of musical numbers, right? And I was actually talking with our boss, Aaron Granite, yesterday about Romeo plus Juliet, and he made this point too, like, the musical numbers, like, the sort of incorporating familiar pop numbers in with this sort of headiness, this kind of, or it's like this big unabashed story of love, these sort of very familiar story conventions. It sort of adds a unique twist, right? Yeah. Which felt very novel at the time.
Or it's like, you could think of it as like a precursor for like the art of the music video too, right?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I think a lot of the flack that this movie takes sort of
like looking like a music video.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like, that's also
not, that was not like me, like,
but that is a,
that wasn't
criticism.
A takedown comment. Yeah. That was like, yeah, that's great.
Okay.
Like,
all
it's
right.
Interesting that
yeah.
it's doing that.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess the idea that this is a 90-minute music video it's not without merit, right? And whether that's a good thing or bad, I guess is up for the individual viewer to decide. But it is a choice. it's a very strong choice. And again, I don't know if... The question is, does it serve the material well? If it does, then great. It's a great movie. If it doesn't, does that bother you?
And here we stand on our divide.
Exactly.
No, I mean, I think it serves its purpose, which is to appeal to teenagers in 1996.
Right.
And it does that extremely well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But beyond 1996?
I don't think it's a music video. I think that's an unfair criticism. Okay. I think that's a very easy criticism to lob at Baz Luhrmann. And I think he actually elevates his material above that. I think that's very unfair.
Okay.
He has some, facility with actors. I think he is interested in, scenes between actors. And he does some interesting things. Like I said, the scene where they meet, the balcony scene, that is certainly him really engaging with the material.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I think that's completely unfair.
Okay. All right.
Well, I'm not saying the whole thing is a music video.
Yeah.
But certainly the rapidity of the cuts, the sort of instability of the camera, the highlighting what you might call emotional shortcuts or emotional shorthand, which I think is interesting. I think that's a positive. You can certainly relate that to a kind of music video aesthetic, but that's just a part of what's going on, right?
Yeah.
And like I was talking about before, where you're dealing with contrast between style that's a little bit more frenetic and when it slows down. I mean, that's a fairly, if we're talking about what elevates it, I think that's a part of what elevates it, is that it's not just like indulgent, sensory experience. It's interested in changing the experience as you move through the film, right? It's interested in kind of overloading your sense of what's going on. One moment, like fireworks and the Queen Mab and, ecstasy drug trip.
Mm-hmm.
And then that all gets to the moment where we slow down and we're in this beautiful, back and forth without dialogue where they meet each other between the aquarium,
mm-hmm.
right? For me, that moment doesn't work as well without that sense of contrast.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, I think we've been kind of roundly... Erica, I don't feel like you were as mean as
No, I wasn't
you
as mean as
did.
I could have been.
Yeah.
I could have been a lot more negative. I'm in a good mood today.
Oh, good.
So Lurie gets a pass.
I know. I mean, Lurie gets a pass. And you know what? I love Shakespeare so much that... Unless your name is Roland Emmerich, go for it. Just take Shakespeare out for a little stroll. I'm for just people adapting it. Keep on making Shakespeare. And if you want to use so Luhrmann set the pattern. He was like, teens and Shakespeare, we're going to do it. We're going to make it happen, guys. And then people did. The 90s were full of Shakespeare teen adaptations.
Yes.
You have you have 10 Things I Hate About You. You have Get Over It. You have which is technically a loose adaptation of Midsummer Night's Dream.
Interesting.
And
then we have Midsummer Night's Dream, right? Wasn't that a...
Yeah, the Whedon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so it's just, not all of them, almost none of them used the text like he did. Most people were like, we'll take the teen in Shakespeare format, but we'll leave the 17th century text over there in the 17th century. It'll be fine.
Their
or 16th in this case. Their choice. But, it inspired people to make more films about Shakespeare using Shakespeare's plays as inspiration, and I'm all for that.
Yeah, sure. And I think this is going to be, whatever became of his career, which obviously I'm not a fan of late stage Luhrmann. But I think one of the really nice legacies of his career is his ability to kind of revitalize genres, right? So in this case, I'm thinking of Shakespeare broadly as a genre. And then he does the same thing for the musical.
Mm-hmm.
Moulin Rouge came out a year before Chicago. It was essentially responsible for revitalizing the musical.
That's a pretty bold claim there, but I don't know if we have time
it's
to unpack
claim.
That just at the moment, but we can put a pin in that.
I'm keeping it 100.
Okay. okay. Well, I think the time has come for me to render a verdict. Is it fair to say that you both... So, Erica, do you think this belongs in the FlixWise favorites list?
Why not?
Not? Yeah?
Yes.
You've worn me down.
Okay. This is a sacred, sacred pantheon.
It could be on your list, but it needs to have the side effects.
Disclaimer. Yeah,
I think it should. Yeah, I think that's a really smart way of packaging all Baz Luhrmann films.
Okay,
just packaging them like pharmaceuticals, because that's kind of what they are.
Yeah, they're like a little popper. I think.
It's a
short. Yeah, short term high.
Yeah,
Also,
we didn't get a chance, but I do love that he turned Queen Mab into a quaalude. I think that's genius.
Oh,
I love that.
So good.
Yeah.
little clever little touches like that. They're kind of littered throughout the movie. That we kind of talked about how the pub where they all hang out is called the Globe, and
got me.
The cute stuff. I don't know. Anyway, is it, Jacob, fair to assume that you think you're pro.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying it's a weird one.
Yeah.
For sure. And rewatching it, I was like, oh, okay, so I'm going to defend it, but there are things about it that I don't remember as well as when I was watching it. But no, I think it's a fascinating film. You know, there's nothing quite like it. And I think on that merit, let's give it to it.
Sure. Yeah, I think you're right that on the basis of novelty alone, it is something notable. It is something worthy of inclusion in the history books. Like you don't find this every day, right? Like this is a very idiosyncratic rendering of this tale. And I do hope other future generations seek it out. I do hope that it is not something, just a nostalgia piece from my childhood. Although I do admit that I have this bias because I did watch it when I was a kid and I did love it.
Yeah.
Unabashedly when I was a kid. So, like...
I will say that, so in terms of, like, contemporary adaptations of it, it is just miles ahead of the truly terrible 2013 version of Romeo and Juliet with Hayley Steinfeld and Douglas Booth. And you know what? This is why I will give Baz a pass for all the crazy stuff that I am not a fan of. And it's because at the end of the day, I think he actually does respect Shakespeare's text to a certain extent. Like he included all of it. He's interested in having the actors actually say the lines. He wants to couch it in his insane stylism, but that's fine. So when Julian Fellowes, who's the guy who made Downton Abbey, was hired to adapt this in 2013, Romeo and Juliet, he made the decision that he was going to basically rewrite most of Romeo and Juliet and cut tons of it and dumb down the lines because his rationale was that young people and audiences are too stupid to understand Shakespeare now. They just are too dumb. They don't understand it. And it is one of the most atrocious, offensive things I've ever seen in my entire life. And so on the basis that I think Baz Luhrmann at least respects his audience enough to think that they can understand what Shakespeare is trying to say, he gets my vote.
Okay. All right.
Nice. Returned her.
Yeah. We have consensus here. That's fantastic. Okay. Well, I agree. I think this is the best Shakespeare filmed adaptation of Shakespeare that I have ever seen, including Zeffirelli.
What are
some other better ones
of Romeo and Juliet or of
Romeo and Juliet, not of like West Side Story is probably better. Of Romeo and Juliet. Yeah,
I mean, for me, I love West Side Story. It's one of my favorite movies.
I mean, I do too. And that's also on the FlixWise favorites list. So,
It's already.
I wouldn't. Definitely not the best Shakespeare adaptation. And maybe we can save some. We're getting to Chimes at Midnight. That is on the list. So that we will discuss at a later date. But as far as adaptations of Romeo and Juliet, I think this one's tops.
Yeah.
Using the text?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. All right. It's in.
Okay. With a shrug, I say, fine. I would die for you. I would die for you. I've been dying just to feel you by my side. To know that you're mine. 'Tis the way we frame it. FlixWise, that is. Listeners, what do you think of Romeo plus Juliet? Come let us know on our website, FlixWise.com, or you can leave us a message on our Facebook page, Facebook.com/FlixWise. If you'd like to discuss which 90s teen heartthrobs were the cutest, you should probably come find me on the Twitter. The handle is @FlixWise. But before you do all of that, please, please go to iTunes, subscribe, rate us, and leave us a nice message. And we'll also accept Shakespearean insults on this occasion only. Limited time. Shakespearean insults are a plus. Okay, coming up on the show, we have another Shakespeare-centered episode. FlixWise co-producer Martin Kessler is working on a FlixWise Canada episode, I believe on adaptations of Macbeth, but you'll have to stay tuned for more.
Throne of Blood's got to be on there, right?
I'm sure. And then FlixWise flagship has Chinatown with James Naremore coming up soon, and a Cassavetes double feature with Michelle and Kate from the Ordinary People episode. And I'm very pleased to announce that the one and only David Bordwell is going to join us for a Casablanca episode.
Oh,
yay!
So good.
I know.
That's gonna be fun.
I know. Some of our listeners may not be familiar with the name Bordwell, but you really, really should be.
For shame.
I know. I know. I mean, so he kind of is the reason I'm here in Madison, Wisconsin. He's sort of the name behind this whole Madison Film Studies School. But if you've ever taken any kind of film studies course in your life, chances are pretty good that you're familiar, at least somewhat familiar with his work, because he and Kristen Thompson literally wrote the book on...
And Jeff Smith now, too.
And what? And Jeff Smith, right?
Yes.
We're adding another name.
Also,
current faculty here at UW-Madison. So it'll be a real honor to have him on. But until then, Erica, thank you for bringing the harsh critique, or at least like the Shakespeare background. You ended up coming around.
You know.
I do
my best.
Yeah.
Tell me why I was dumb to think that they were pirates.
No, I love that we got to talk about Shakespeare in Love. I'm always happy to talk about that film. I think it's fascinating.
All right. And so do you have any a Twitter handle you'd like to plug?
It's at Erica, ERICA underscore Moulton, MOULTON.
Hey,
so, you know, follow me and I'll tweet about Shakespeare.
Done. Okay. And Jacob?
You can't find me.
No.
I'm incognito.
All right.
I will also say I am going to be starting a Shakespeare podcast shortly. So maybe we can, you know, look out on the Twitter for that.
Yeah. There we go. We will keep you posted. All right. Well, Jacob, thanks for sticking up for Bazzy.
No problem.
Do you think that's what people call him, Bazzy?
I hope so.
I hope so. Mm-hmm. I hope that's what Nicole Kidman calls him.
And Leo.
I like to imagine that they're just like,
Leo's just up at, you know, 1 a.m. It's like, Bazzy, you up?
Yes. Oh, my God.
If anyone is sending the thirsty texts, though, it's definitely Baz to Leo.
Oh, yeah.
That's
you up?
True.
For sure.
You're right. I've got to admit it.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. He's thirsty for Leo.
All right. Well, I think we're going to arrange to have you both on again, possibly for more Leo goodness.
Absolutely.
Yeah? All right. Or maybe we need another Kate film, as in... Kate Winslet. Have I mentioned that we did a Titanic episode? If you enjoyed this, you might want to go back and give that one a listen as well. But until next time, shall we say goodnight to Lepi Morrow?
Oh, parting is such sweet sorrow.
And good.
Hit it right on cue.